Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's Dharma Talk is entitled Transforming Confusion into Wisdom, The Five Buddha Families, Part 1, by Lama Kathy Wesley. We can sometimes feel intimidated by the path to awakening. Our clouds of confusion can feel so thick and wisdom so far away. But the methods of Dharma can help us make the path more possible. By reviewing the teachings on the five wisdoms, Lama Kathy will show how we can purify our negativities and uncover our inner Buddha qualities. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karma Teksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Well, thank you very much for coming in today. I know it's the Labor Day holiday, and so a lot of folks have plans for the weekend, but I'm really happy to see all of you today and for you to be here. By the way, I have to admire anybody who wears a Cowabunga t-shirt too. I like the Ninja Turtles, and I'm also a fan of Usagi Yojimbo. They live in a different universe, kind of, but anyway. Yeah, so if you can Google that, folks. Usagi Yojimbo. He's a samurai rabbit who lives in feudal Japan. Anyway, okay, so beyond that, I'd like to give some appreciation to all the volunteers here at KTC. When I came in today, it was very gratifying to see people at the front desk volunteering, people downstairs volunteering. The Shrine Beautiful, as always, thank you, Shrine Team. And Don at the podium in the back, thank you, Sound Team. So it's really wonderful to see the community working together to create this great space where we can welcome people to sit and meditate and to connect to what's good within them. So, in any case, I decided that for this week and next week, since I'm doing two talks in a row, that I would start with one topic today and continue it into next week. So that way I can go a little bit more in depth on something. And the topic that I've chosen is the five Buddha families, which sounds kind of like, okay, what's that? But that's okay. It's one of the many head-scratching number teachings in Buddhism. You know, we have the Four Noble Truths, which were the basic teachings of the Buddha, the Four Immeasurable Meditations, love, compassion, joy, equanimity. I mean, the reason that numbers are so prevalent and ubiquitous in Buddhism is because the philosophy and teachings of Buddhism are 2,500 years old. And in the older times, books were not as available as they are today. And so if people wanted to learn the teachings, if they wanted to learn the teachings of the Buddha, they couldn't just go to a library and get a book. They had to meet another human being and receive one-on-one teachings. And as an aid to memory, the numbering system was developed so that people could remember the teachings and have a sense of internalizing them through memorization. And in fact, in the earliest days of Buddhism, the monastics memorized all of the Buddha's teachings because his very first disciple one of his first disciples, the Buddha's first disciples, Ananda, had the gift that we now call total recall. You might call it a photographic memory, but it's for words. And he memorized everything the Buddha said and was able to recite it verbatim. And he taught other monastics the teachings in this way. And then they got handed down for 100 years in this way before they were written into books. But the numbering system helps us to keep track of and understand whether we have truly internalized something. Because if you're told that there are four noble truths and you remember two of them, you know you got something. And you know that you've got a little more you have to learn. By the way, the first of the noble truths is suffering, that suffering's part of life. No matter how fast we run, there will be suffering, even with us as we run. Then the second noble truth, by the way, the purpose of the first noble truth is so that we will recognize that suffering is not something that we need to run really fast away from, that we know we're going to have it wherever we are, so we need to learn to cope, and we need to learn to accept and to work with suffering rather than fighting it. And so that's the first of the noble truths. The second is that suffering has a cause, and it's not external. It's not the neighbor or the boss. It's not the neighbor or the boss, or even ourselves. The real cause of suffering, according to the teachings of the Buddha, is from inside of ourselves, from our grasping and our clinging and our expectations and our wish for things to be other than what they are, and our insistence that they become what we want them to be. But the good news is, since it was a second noble truth, the first and second noble truth, there's a third noble truth, which is that the suffering can be relinquished, it can be unmade. Since it has a cause, that cause can be reversed. And then the fourth noble truth is the path that leads to the reversal of our mental afflictions and our suffering. So in this way, through using a numbering system, we can learn the Dharma little by little by little by little. But it all comes down to one thing, and that is all of the Dharma can be summarized very simply by saying we all know that we have gifts and potentials. We all know that we have that, but we haven't realized them yet. We all know that we want to be better than what we are now. We all want to be better. I mean, I kind of want to lose some weight, I kind of want to exercise more, but even beyond those kinds of things, we all want to be happier, kinder, gentler, wiser. We want to be a little bit more than what we are now. And sometimes that goal seems like it's out of reach. It seems like it's really far away. I was talking with a person earlier today who said that she had just started the practice of quiet sitting meditation, which we call shamatha, or calm abiding. And she said, there's one thing that's happened to me that I'm a little confused about. She said, I begin to recognize my thoughts when I'm not meditating, and I don't like what I see. She said, I used to think I was a pretty nice person. She said, but now that I've become a meditator and I've actually begun to watch my thoughts, I've begun to observe my thoughts, she said, I found out that I am not the person I thought I was, and that I'm actually quite impatient and sometimes very negative. And I said, well, that's important information. It's good information. It's information. What do they say? It's news you can use, right? It's information that, I said, the good news is that you recognize you've got these tendencies and that there's something you can do to correct them. And it all comes from meditation. It all comes from being able to practice with your thoughts and to work with your thoughts. So sometimes the idea of Buddha, which we see represented here on the shrine, sometimes the idea of Buddha just seems like it's so far out of reach that there's just no way we're going to be sitting on a lotus flower with our hands in meditation peacefully. It's somehow it's just not in our future. But we actually do have, according to the teachings given by the Buddha, we have hidden potential, and we have a lot of interior gifts and talents. And these inner potentials and gifts can help us become what we might call the best version of ourselves. The ideal path toward this also would let us take others into consideration, because meditation may be a solitary activity, but we live in community. So even though we're solitary meditators in our homes, here we enter community and come into community. And when we do that, it would be ideal if we could take others with us as we practice meditation, take others with us as we try to work to change ourselves and to grow. So we don't have to think we're walking the path alone. We can take other people with us. So the Buddha, it was said, so we need a path. So the Buddha taught the path in lots of different ways. In fact, they say that the Buddha taught 84,000 teachings of Dharma. Dharma means truth. So 84,000 teachings meant to counteract the 84,000 types of mental affliction. Now, I haven't done any counting of that lately. And I sort of think the number 84,000 is not exact. It might be plus or minus a few. But I think the number is given as a way of saying a lot, a lot, a lot. And we can transform those mental afflictions, because these mental afflictions all have a common birthplace. They all come from the same place. These mental afflictions all arise from the same place. Their birthplace is in our mind. Dharma teachings tell us that the mind is vast and deep like an ocean, and that thoughts, feelings, and emotions are like the waves on top of that ocean. Most of us spend our lives like surfing, you know, surfing on the tops of our thoughts, feelings, and emotions. We kind of spend our time surfing, and we are unaware that there's more to our mind, you know, that we're unaware that there's more to our mind than just these surface experiences. And so we learn about this through the practice of meditation. When we start meditating, we begin to learn that there's more to us than just our thoughts, our feelings, and our emotions. The Buddha likewise taught that even though our minds are vast and deep, and that we unfortunately spend a lot of time surfing on the top of the ocean, we have some potentials. And we have potentials for goodness, we have potentials for compassion, we have potential for wisdom, we have potentials for all of these things. We have all of this within us. Those of you who are familiar with the author Pema Chodron know that in her book, Start Where You Are, she says, in some ways, she said, we already have everything we need. I thought that was quite a bold statement. We already have everything we need. It's just that we have to find a way to get to it and to make use of it. Why is that difficult? Well, another thing that the Buddha taught was that we all have habits. In fact, some of them are so old. Some of our habits are so old, they come to us from previous lifetimes, because the Buddha taught that our minds were never created, And because our minds were never created, they can't go out of existence, but just go through a series of experiences, one after the other, after the other, after the other. Some people call this reincarnation. Some people call it rebirth. I call it a minute from now, because a minute from now, I will literally be a different person than I am this second. And 2 minutes from now, I'll be a different person still. We are all just continuing iterations of the same thing that change and morph through time. That's kind of both bad news and good news. The bad news is that we have some habits from previous lifetimes that I jokingly call karmic presets. We have these sort of karmic presets from previous lifetimes. Like this poor lady who I was talking to this morning, she said, I didn't realize how impatient I am. I'm really impatient with people, and then that makes me angry. She didn't even realize that this was part of her personality until she started meditating, because you know what the process of meditation does. You're sitting there quietly, and you're resting your attention on the breath, or at least we're trying to rest our attention on the breath, and that as the thoughts come and go, we're just trying to stick with the breath instead. But then what happens is that we'll inevitably be distracted by some thought of the past or the future or something, and then we'll notice that we're not meditating anymore. We'll notice that we're not with the breath anymore, and then we will have to decide what to do next. And the teaching goes that when that happens, you notice that you are thinking and not meditating. You can even label it thinking. You can let it go, and then you can return your attention to the breath as though for a fresh start, as though you're refreshing and giving yourself a fresh start. And when you do that and you let that thought go, where does it go? It kind of, in some cases, just disappears. And when that happens, that gives us a clue about the potential that mind has to be changed. Even our presets can be changed, because that's what our habits are made of, these moment-to-moment-to-moment-to-moment thoughts. And if those thoughts can change and disappear, then we can replace them with other thoughts, things that are different. That's what I told the woman I spoke to this morning. I said, well, you know, you could choose something different. Not maybe this minute. Maybe you don't think you could choose something different, but gradually, as you train, you'll be able to find a different way of working with these karmic presets. And so the teachings say that some of these presets may be difficult, if not impossible, to uproot, but that we can soften them. We can soften them and change how they manifest. I actually saw somebody do this one time. They were having a discussion, we'll call it discussion, with someone, and they suddenly stopped and said, you know what, I'm going to do something different now. They actually stopped the argument and took a step back and said, you know what, I'm coming at this all wrong. Let's start again. Let's do something different. And I know that sounds like an almost impossible idea, that somebody could be in the middle of an argument and then suddenly say, you know what, could we take a time out and start this again? I've seen it done. And what this means is that through the shamatha meditation practice, which I call taming the mind, we're trying to tame it. We're trying to tame our attention. Through taming the mind, we can begin to soften our reactions and soften our reactiveness. We can begin to soften it and blunt the force of it. But then over time, we can get inside the works, inside our hearts and minds, and begin to make subtle changes. Instead of this, do that. Instead of saying this, say that. Instead of thinking this, think that. And then gradually we can make those changes. So, As we do our practice of shamatha, we see that we can change. But that's not all we see when we do shamatha practice. The person I was talking to this morning said, I've also noticed, she said, that when one thought has stopped before the next one starts, there's a gap in between thoughts. And she said, that's interesting. And I said, yes, it is. Because that is what I call unclaimed territory. No flag. There's no flag in that piece of ground. And what it also is evidence of, it's also evidence that there's more to us than just those waves of thoughts, feelings, and emotions that are on top of the ocean that is our mind, that there's some depth there also, and that there's probably more to us than just our thoughts. There's more to us than just our feelings and our emotions. There's more to our mind than that. We become aware of deeper levels of mind, and a place where our mind is different. It's peaceful, it's compassionate, it's open, it's relaxed, it's maybe even wise. Maybe even wise. So we call this unclaimed territory, ordinary mind in Tibetan Buddhism. Ordinary mind, but we also call it by another name. We call it Buddha nature. We call it Buddha nature. It's who we are really. And it's not necessarily a who, it's a what. Our mind is beyond our ability to describe what it is. It's vast, it's deep, it has no color, it has no shape, it has no location, it has no beginning, it has no end. We cannot discern that. But if we reflect upon that, we begin to get a sense of those potentials and possibilities and gifts that we have inside of us. Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, a number of years ago, said, if you only knew who you really were, if you only knew who you really were and what you were capable of, he said, you would be astonished and amazed. You would be astonished and amazed. If you only knew who you were and what you were capable of, he said, you would be astonished and amazed. But how do we begin to work with that? Where do we go with that? It's great to know we have it, but how do we work with it? How do we develop it? How do we find it? How do we nurture it? Well, lucky for us, the Buddha gave teachings on this also. And he said that by working with the thoughts, feelings, and emotions, working with them, not against them, working with them, discovering what they really are. By working with our thoughts, feelings, and emotions on the surface of the ocean of our mind, we can gradually come to know what is deeper under the surface, what's deeper within us. And he further gave teachings on how what he called the five mental poisons. The five mental poisons. Yes, there's another number. Don't worry, I'll tell you what, but they are one by one. He said there's a way of transforming our five mental poisons into five types of wisdom. Five mental poisons transformed into five types of wisdom. Okay, everybody hearing this is probably saying, I'd like to have a ticket for that, please. Could you show me how to transform my anger into wisdom? I'm all ears. Well, the Buddha said that if we are able to work on resting our mind and seeing the basic nature of everything as being limitless, and open and aware, then that sort of busts up or breaks up our tendency to close down and to be sort of claustrophobically clutching onto things, people, ideas, and emotions, and so on. So one of the ways that they teach this openness is by giving a teaching about the five Buddha families and the five Buddha wisdoms. And if we practice these five Buddha families or five Buddha wisdoms, we can, over a period of time, come to see even our worst fault as a potential for waking up. And this has been, the five Buddha families are taught in many books on Tibetan Buddhism. The two that I'm going to be basing my remarks on today are, there's one that's a pretty good size and one that's kind of tiny. So I'll give you the name of the tiny one first. The tiny one is called the five Buddha families and the eight consciousnesses. It's a, just a very short teaching by Thongu Rinpoche, and his name is spelled T-H-R-A-N, N like Nancy, G like George, U, Thongu Rinpoche. And it's a very concise statement about the five Buddha wisdoms and how we train in them. And the other book is called Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. It's a very mysterious title, but it's by Chogyam Trungpa, so I'll spell the last name. T as in Tom, R as in Richard, U, N as in Nancy, G as in George, P as in Paul, A, Trungpa. He's a somewhat controversial figure from 1970s and 1980s Buddhism, but his teachings are very clear and very easy to connect to and understand. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to spend a few minutes now before opening the floor for questions. Like to spend a few minutes now talking about the five Buddha families in general, and then I'm going to describe two of them, and then next week I will describe the remaining three. And in this way, we'll be able to get an idea of the framework, because that's really, the five Buddha families is both a teaching on the wisdoms that we have and the qualities that we have, because everybody is a mixture of all five of these mental afflictions, which means we're also a mixture of all five of these wisdoms. Because when you transform the confusion, it is transformed into the wisdom. In other words, it's always there. The wisdom is always there. We don't see it, and we go the opposite direction from it, but when we turn back toward it, we begin to realize it and to nurture it and to bring it to fruition in our minds. But the other good thing about the five Buddha families teaching is that it helps us to understand ourselves and it helps us to understand other people. Because in Trungpa's presentation, he says that in our own personality, we will see one or two of the five mental afflictions predominating. In other words, there will be more of one kind of confusion in our mind than another. But that's also true of everybody else. Everybody else has a preponderance of another mental affliction. And we can, I mean, I don't mean to say we can pigeonhole people, because that's, of course, what one unfortunate outcome of this kind of teaching is that we can say, well, that person's a this and that person's a that, and we can just kind of pigeonhole them and put them away so we don't have to think about them, right? Because, you know, if we put them in a little box, then we don't have to think about them. That's really not the purpose of this. The purpose of this is to see that we all have these potentials and that we all have these potential detriments and potential wisdoms. And that we can, if we can understand them and understand ourselves, then we'll be able to understand others too and have some compassion for them. I'm actually just going to read part of the Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism. This is the chapter on Tantra and what he has to say. He says here, he says, when we speak of being developed spiritually, this does not mean that we float in the air. In fact, the higher we go, the more we come down to earth. It's important to remember that the practice of meditation begins with the penetration of the neurosis thought patterns, our neuroses, our confused thought patterns, which he called the fringe of the egocentrism that we tend to have. We tend to be very self-centered and self-fixated, you know. We're not all my way or the highway kind of people, but you know, we are our own biggest fans, I just have to say, in many cases. I don't know about you, but that's my unfortunate case. But what meditation does is it begins to pierce through those reaction patterns to say, aha, look at you, you're impatient again, like that the poor woman who was trying to change her habit today. So then he said, as we proceed further through meditation, we see through not only the complexity of the thought processes, because we drop those thoughts in meditation, but also the heavy meaningfulness of concepts expressed in names and theories. In other words, the fact that we paint meaning on things by how we think about them. Like, oh, that's a good thing, that's a bad thing, and so on. Then he says, at last we create some space between this and that, which liberates us tremendously. In other words, we soften our approach of judgment. We soften our judgmental approach, and that gives us some freedom. Having created this space, we then go on to the Vajrayana practice, or the Tantra practice, of creating a direct link with life experience. In other words, in the Buddhist teachings, there are three levels of practice. The self-liberation, or the individual liberation path, which is called the Hinayana. The path for the liberation of all, which is called the Mahayana. And the Vajrayana, which is the path of what they call the indestructible path. So quiet sitting meditation is our self-liberation, or our individual liberation practice. Compassion meditation is our liberation for all practice. Those of you who've learned the Tonglen practice, or the meditation on compassion, that's our Mahayana practice. But our Vajrayana practice is the practice of Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of compassion, which is a mantra practice. So he says we go on through meditation and compassion to connect with directly with our life experiences. These three steps are, in essence, the three yanas, the Hinayana, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana. He said, in the tantric tradition, energy is categorized in five basic qualities, or five Buddha families. And these five Buddha families have names that are based on Sanskrit words. Because if you remember, Buddhism came from India, so Sanskrit was one of the classical languages of India. It wasn't the Buddha's language, but it was one of the main languages that Buddhism was translated into in the early days. So each of these five Buddha families has a name that comes from Sanskrit. The first one is called Vajra, which is V like in victory, A, J as in James, R as in Rebecca, A as in apple, Vajra. And that means indestructible. indestructible. And the second Buddha family is called Ratna, which means jewel or precious. And that's R, A, T is in Tabitha, N is in Nancy, A, Ratna. The third Buddha family is called Padma, P as in Paul, A, D as in Dorothy, M as in Mary, A, Padma, and that means lotus. The fourth Buddha family is called Karma, K as in Kathy, A, R, M as in Mary, A, and it means activity. And the last one is one you will know. Buddha, B as in boy, U, D as in Dorothy, D as in Dorothy, H as in Harry, A as in apple, Buddha, which means awakened. Trungpa Rinpoche said each of these Buddha families has an emotion associated with it that is transmuted into a particular wisdom or aspect of the awakened mind. The Buddha families are also associated with colors, elements, landscapes, directions, seasons of the year, and any aspect of the phenomenal world. In other words, when we learn about these principles, we learn not just about the emotional side of things, we also learn about how these are associated with everything we see, how our whole world, in a way, either is suffused by these ideals and these ideas. And it also, part of the reason that I'm giving this, I have to tell you, I have a secret reason for wanting to give this teaching. I've got several secret reasons that I will now tell you, so they're not secret anymore. One is I want to talk to you a little bit about why this room is yellow and why the other colors of the rainbow, the five basic primary colors, are here, why they're here, and what they mean and what they symbolize, because you're going to be seeing more color in this room as time goes along. Eventually, there will be banners hanging from each of the pillars, and there will be banners hanging from the tallest beams. These fabric banners will have ribbons from the five colors, and then there will be painting or wallpaper actually placed at the top of the wall that will also have five colors. And you will say to yourself, wow, what's that mean? It symbolizes, these five colors symbolize the five wisdoms. And the thought is that when a person enters this room, they will naturally be magnetized by the beauty of the colors, and that the colors will speak to them about something that's inside them, something that's pure and true that's inside them. And anyway, so that's my first secret reason. Second one I'll reveal next week, so stay tuned. So how much time do we have? Oh, okay. I don't have much time, so what I'm going to do is I will at least start with the first of the five Buddha families, but I'm going to read directly from the book, and I might be able to get the first two in. We'll see. The first of the five Buddha families is the Vajra family. Now, again, remember, he said it's associated with an emotional state, color, element, landscape, season of the year, and so forth. So here he's going to give each one of those. And by the way, this comes from the teachings in the Tibetan tradition. He says the negative emotion it's associated with is anger. And that is transmuted into what is called mirror-like wisdom. Now, you know, when we are angry, we tend to become laser-focused on what we are angry at, and it's out there, and it's not us, and it's not us, and it's not us, and it's out there, and so forth. Well, the idea of mirror-like wisdom being the opposite of that is that instead of this angry outward focus, we actually see the sameness of everything. That there's that the ideas of enemy and friend are labels that we add to things, and that if we really look at ourselves, we'll see something different. He says, we sense something is beyond the cloudy, possessive, and aggressive qualities of anger. And this intuitive insight enables us to transform the essence of anger into precision and openness. Precision and openness rather than possessive and aggressive, which I just think is lovely. Vajra is also associated with the element of water. Cloudy, turbulent water symbolizes the defensive and aggressive nature of anger, while clear water suggests the sharp, precise, clear reflectiveness of mirror-like wisdom. Vajra is associated with the color white. Anger is very blunt and direct, is the very blunt and direct experience of defending oneself. Therefore, it is like a sheet of white paper, flat and opaque, but it also has the potential of luminosity, the brilliance of reflection, which is mirror-like wisdom. Vajra is associated with the direction of the east, with the dawn, with winter. It's a winter morning, crystal clear, icicles sharp and glittering. The landscape is not empty or desolate, but is full of all sorts of thought-provoking sharpness. There are many things to intrigue the observer. The ground, the trees, the plants all have their own way of freezing. Different trees have different ways of carrying snow and different ways of relating to temperature. The Vajra family deals with objects in terms of their textures and their relations to each other. Everything is analyzed in its own terms. The intelligence of Vajra never leaves any unexplored areas or hidden corners. It is like water flowing over a flat surface, completely covering the surface but remaining transparent. And there's a Buddha that is associated with the Vajra family, and Trungpa Rinpoche speaks about that in his book. That there's a Buddha that symbolizes the transformation of anger. And this is the Buddha Akshobhya, which I will spell for you. A is in apple, K is in Kathy, S is in Samantha, H, O, B is in boy, H is in Harriet, Y, A, Akshobhya. And his name means the unmovable. You can't move him. The immovable, the idea that he is solid and he is present and he is all wisdom. And it's very interesting because there are two main documents that explain the five Buddha families. And in the document that Trungpa describes, it's the color white. But in this, it's the color deep, dark blue, almost black. It's really deep. So whether you say that it is one or the other, these both of them have the idea or carry the idea of the transformation of anger into wisdom. And I have just enough time. Do I have just enough time? I have just enough time to read about the Ratna family, and then we'll stop for today. Ratna is associated with pride, the mental affliction of pride. But it's also associated with earth, the element of earth. Solidity, mountains, hills, pyramids, buildings. It's almost as though this energy says, I am completely secure, I am what I am. It is a very proud way and confident way of looking at oneself. However, this means that one is also afraid to loosen up and is continually piling up defenses, building a fortress. Equally, Ratna is the wisdom of equanimity, which is all-pervading. Whether you construct buildings out of earth or whether you simply leave the earth as it is, it's the same thing. The earth remains as it is. You don't feel defeated or threatened at all. If you are a proud person, you feel yourself constantly challenged by the possibility of failure and defeat. In the enlightened mind, the anxiety of maintaining one's ego is transmuted into feelings of equanimity, being at peace. There is still the awareness of solidity and stability, but there's no fear of losing it. Everything is open, safe, and dignified. There is nothing to fear. Ratna is related to the south, the direction of the south, and the season of autumn, fertility, richness in the sense of continual generosity. When fruit is ripe, it automatically falls to the ground, asking to be eaten up. Ratna has this kind of giving away quality. It is luscious and open with the quality of mid-morning. Its color is yellow, connected with the sun's rays. Whereas Vajra is associated with crystal, Ratna is gold, amber, saffron. It has a sense of depth, real earthiness rather than texture, whereas Vajra is purely texture, a crispy quality rather than fundamental depth. Ratna is so ripe and earthy, it is like a gigantic tree which falls to the ground and begins to rot and grow mushrooms all over it and is enriched by the weeds growing around it. It's a log in which animals might nest. Its color begins to turn to yellow and its bark peels off, revealing an interior which is very rich and solid. He says, if you were to attempt to remove this rotting log in order to use it as part of a garden arrangement, it would be impossible to move because it would crumble and fall apart, giving itself away. Anyway, so we'll stop there. I wanted to stop with the color yellow because when I thought and began to think about and work with the shrine design team on this room, one of the things that came to mind was this yellow color, which is associated with Ratna, generosity, giving, and this sense of solidity and earth, that this room is grounded by the color yellow, and it will be decorated by the other colors, which will soften its effect. So anyhow, that's what I wanted to talk about today, was how we have these potentials. All of us have these potentials within us. And if we have some time for questions, you can either ask about what we talked about today or anything. So the question microphone is open. And if you have questions, great. Okay, here. We have a customer. Yeah, we have two customers. Okay, very good. All right.
Good morning, Lama Kathy. Thank you so much for this teaching.
No, thank you.
I want to go back to something you said early about that space that we can find between our thoughts. And over time, I find that I'm not as impulsive as I used to be between my thought and my action or reaction. If I'm mindful, right?
What's that?
If I am mindful, there is this space, and it's a really wonderful and transformative space. But I've been wondering, is that a different kind of space than the space between simple, but the space between
right.
thoughts and the space between thought and action?
I completely understand that. And I think I will venture to say they are both the same and different. Okay, I know that's a weird answer, but I will say they're both the same in that when we allow a space to open up in conversation, in a presentation, when someone says something to us, if we allow a space to open up, we're opening up a potential for something to happen. And we're also not jumping into the space impulsively, as you mentioned. And I think when I first started giving presentations, people told me, you know, you can be silent between sentences. You don't just have to keep going. And I think that that's something I had to learn to do. I had to learn to slow the presentation down so that there could be some gaps. But in any case, so I think being mindful allows us to be okay with the space, to know that the space will not cause some kind of damage or harm, and that the space may actually bring comfort both to the speaker and the listener, you know, so that there's just more space around everything, so that there's not this claustrophobic grasping. Because when you think about ego clinging or ego fixation, which the Buddha said was the cause of suffering, right? Ego fixation and grasping, it's very claustrophobic, it's very shut down, it's very tiny. But when you allow a space to open up between hearing something and saying something, that gives a feeling of relaxation both to you and to the person who's with you. It's an act of generosity in some ways. And but in terms of what the space between thoughts is, it just I think it is an open. It's the same thing. That's why I'm saying it's the same and different. It's the same in that we begin to see that we don't have to rush to fill that space with mental chatter, that we are actually okay with a moment of non-conceptual, not conceiving, not judging, non-conceptual relaxation. And so it's not that, so that's why it's a little bit the same, but it's a little bit different, because within that, we can begin to see that there's more to us than we think, and we get an inkling or a little idea about what we could be and how things could be. And so it's both the same and a little different. And that eventually from that space, if we learn how to rest in it without anxiety, without anxiety, expectation, thinking, whatever, then there's some wisdom that can arise in that space. But what that is, we're going to have to wait and find out. It's described in the texts, but, you know.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hey, no, thank you. Thank you. Yeah. There's time for one or two more. Yeah. Nice shirt.
Good morning. It's the right color, isn't it?
I tell you what, I must say he has... you have inadvertently been the illustration for today's, the five Buddha families are represented in the five prayer flags on his shirt. Yes, hi.
Hi. My question revolves around thoughts. And I'm curious if the the content of thoughts, the type of thoughts that we have are influenced by our karma. Is our karma kind of manifesting some of itself in the form of thought?
I've got to tell you, you are spot on with that. Okay, you are spot on. At least according to the teachings that I have heard. At least according to the teachings that I have heard, you're spot on. I'll give you an example. Tralai Rinpoche wrote a book called Karma, What It Is, What It Isn't, and Why It Matters. And he says that directly and exactly. He says exactly that a lot of the thoughts that arise in our mind are flavored and influenced by our karmic accumulation, sort of our presets, those presets about how we view the world, how we view ourselves. Those thoughts come from our karmic background. And so, and Kempo Kartha Rinpoche, in another teaching that he gave years ago, he said, we will probably never be able to get hold of that first moment of reaction. When something happens to us and we go, or something happens and we go, ooh, you know, we may not be able to stop that first moment because of the influence of karma. However, through training the mind, we can have a different response in the second, third, fourth, fifth moment after that first moment of reaction. He said you can get hold of the reaction. At first, it won't be for a long time. You'll have the input, and then you'll have the emotional reaction. And then it'll take a little while for that emotional reaction to play out enough so that you can turn the boat around, so to speak. You can turn things around and get hold of it. But he said, as you get better at meditation, he says you're going to get closer and closer and closer to recognizing the moment of emotion when it's happening. And then once you recognize it in the moment, he says, then you really have a choice. You get more choices as to how you can react. And he said, not only could you react to that moment of anger by saying to yourself, may this anger contain the anger of all beings and may all of us be free of it, which is the love and compassion mind training response to a sudden fit of anger. You could also ask yourself the question, who is angry? Where is the one that thinks that this is bad? What is the mind that's having that thought? And there's a potential for discovery right inside that thought, which I have now, spoiler alert, given away how negative mental afflictions are transformed into wisdom. Sorry, folks, but still tune in next week. Do you see where I'm going with this? Yes, sorry about that.
I was more focused or thinking about the content of
the content.
Thought.
Oh,
not,
absolutely.
Not the reaction so much as the content.
And, content.
And yep. By doing more virtue, do we improve the quality of our thoughts?
You sure do. It's direct replacement. The content is also determined by karma, according to the teachings of Tralai Rinpoche and Kempo Rinpoche. The content definitely is karmic. And then after that, but that's why training, you can turn it around and make it something different. You replace the negative reaction with something positive. So if you do more virtue, you have more of a virtuous karmic preset, right?
Right.
So that's where your thoughts are going to start coming from. Some people even say they start dreaming about the Dharma and actually changing their reactions to things that happen in their dreams. The things that happen in their dreams actually change. As they do more virtuous things, their dreams change. So that means it's really working on us at like the deepest level. So the content will change.
Okay, so then about the elongating of that space between thoughts, is that more for mind training or is that from karma?
The elongating the space, that's training. Yeah, but you have the capacity to do it, so that's karma. It's a little bit of both, right? You have the capacity to do it, so that's a little bit of karma, right? And you have to, but you have to train to stay in it. Yes. Ooh, this will be the last question today.
So I heard a very wise teaching by a Lama that said karma is what the basic idea of karma is. What you is you do a lot. What you do a lot.
Yeah. What you do a lot. You do a lot.
That was Lama Kathy who said that. So it includes your thoughts. Thoughts is something you do. You cultivate thoughts and you go over and over them, or you learn to cultivate different thoughts, or every time you have a bad thought, you say, oh no, that's an unhealthy way of thinking,
right.
And you train yourself. So what you do a lot, you do a lot.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. And that's actually it. Yeah, I like to you know, because I have a background, my degree's in journalism. I love words, and I have always loved words, and it's really been a blessing, you know, to be able to use my education to come up with ideas and ways of talking about dharmic principles so that they're not so ponderous and not so difficult. But yeah, that's one of the ways, you know, what you do a lot, you do a lot. And we start a momentum that's karmic that will then give birth to the next moment and then the next moment. So I'm really glad you asked these questions or made these comments, because it just shows and illustrates how we are currently engaged in making and remaking our experience of the world, like continuously. And so even though it feels out of control right now, and for many of us, it, like me, it continues to be a little bit out of control, we're slowly changing our habits. And as we slowly change our habits, our thoughts will change and our defaults will change and we'll be in a different place. And hopefully it will be a good place, be a good place. Yeah, thank you. By the way, Tim, you did a favor to me because you held this, you know, when you changed your seat, and it reminded me I totally forgot to do the prayer. I was so excited to talk to y'all. So we're going to, like, do the dedication, though. Okay. We're going to call together all the goodness that we've generated by being here and meditating and being here and talking. We're going to take all that goodness and dedicate it to everyone so that everyone can benefit from it. So we'll recite this through the dedication one time in English. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Thank you, everyone. It's wonderful to see you today. And thanks to everybody watching at home. Thank you so much for being here, and have a good week. And we'll see you next week, same time, same place.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling, or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.